morning, everybody. This is Dr. Narimoto Hartford. This is from the Temple of Health. And today we have the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Robert Sears, who is a pediatrician in California. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
How are you doing? Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us during the holidays. I know it has to be hectic with you guys, so I really, really appreciate taking the time to talk to us.
Well, I'm very happy to be on the show.
Well, thank you. I have been wanting to actually talk to you for a long time. I love your book. Dr. Robert Sears is the author of the new book, the vaccine book. It's a very, very thorough, very informative book for everybody, for physicians, for whomever is in the medical field, and especially for caregivers for the kids. He talks about the vaccinations from actually newborn all the way for 16, 17 years old. I guess they are not kids anymore, adolescents. So I am actually really thrilled to talk to you and pick your brain.
Oh, yeah. This is my most favorite topic to discuss, and I think it's a very important topic, and I think every parent, especially every new parent, has questions about vaccines and is wondering about vaccines. So, yeah, I'm very, very happy to talk about them.
Oh, good. Well, I would like to know if you can give us a pointer on why did you decide to do the book. And I'm very sure this book is very thorough. It's a really good book. It tells you about how different vaccines are made, different formulas from different manufacturers, which is actually not very easy to find. And also tells you about different vaccination as far as which ones are the more common one, which one are the scarier one. And this is going to be an open session, and please, by any means, go ahead and tell us what you want to for our listeners to know.
Well, I wrote the book because I think nowadays parents simply want to know more about the vaccines that they're giving their babies. In the old days, most parents simply just got the vaccines without asking any questions. And most parents didn't wonder what was in them or what the side effects might be. They just kind of followed the doctor's orders without asking. But nowadays, I think parents, with the internet and with books out there, parents are seeking out more information about vaccines. They want to know details. And when I looked at what's out there on the market, pretty much all the books that are out there are very anti-vaccine and don't give both sides of the story. And there are some books that are totally pro-vaccine that don't give any of the sides of the story on the anti-vaccine side. So I wanted to put together something that gave both sides of the issue all together in one place, so that parents could just sit down and read it all and make an educated decision for their child.
Yes, I do remember in your book, every chapter that you talk about different vaccines, you actually don't give any recommendation for pros or cons of if you would strongly recommend this, a patient or a kid has to have this vaccine, otherwise it's the end of the world, or no, don't worry about this vaccine. It's basically up to the parents what they want to decide, which I think is such a wonderful way of giving the parents the feel of they are in charge now again.
Yeah, exactly. And overall, I do feel vaccines are very important, and I think parents. Yeah, I do think ultimately, I do recommend getting the vaccines. But yeah, in the book, I don't push parents into it. Or you're right. I don't say you're crazy if you don't vaccinate.
Yeah,
you're wrong,
yeah,
if you don't vaccinate. But overall, as a pediatrician, I do feel that vaccines are very important.
Yes. Now, I wanted to, I guess, go from the first few chapters, the HIV vaccine and the PC vaccine, and I wanted to get your point of view on that and to see what you think about different vaccinations.
Okay. Well, the first two vaccines that I talk about in the book that you just alluded to are the two infant meningitis vaccines. They're called HIB, or HIB, and PC vaccines. These two protect against the two forms of meningitis that we see in babies and toddlers. And HIB used to be extremely common. There used to be about 20,000 infants infected with HIB every year back in the 70s and 80s, and there were hundreds of fatalities every year in the country. And we came out with HIB vaccine in the middle of the 1980s, and since that time, HIB has mostly been eliminated. We now only see about 25 cases of HIB meningitis every year in our country. It's extremely rare now, thanks to vaccines. And so that's HIB is one of the meningitis vaccines. The PC vaccine protects against something called, it's a big word, but it's pneumococcal meningitis. That actually now is the most common infant and toddler meningitis in the country. Pneumococcal meningitis, and I call the vaccine PC vaccine. And this protects against a meningitis that is that affects probably around 2,000 babies every year in the country. That's a rough estimate. We see a couple thousand severe cases of PC disease in the country, and so this vaccine is given during infancy to help avoid that.
Now, is this mostly the PC? The PC vaccine, didn't it sort of started because of the to help prevent ear infections in little kids, or that is another vaccine?
No, that is the PC vaccine, but that's a misconception. The PC germs, the bacteria that cause meningitis, can also cause ear infections.
Okay.
But there are many, many other causes of ear infections as well. So simply by giving a PC vaccine, you might prevent the PC types of ear infections, but you're not really going to lower the amount of overall ear infections much. So in reality, PC vaccine is not considered much protection against ear infections. That's
okay.
Kind of a misconception.
Okay. And now the PC vaccine, how many different, I'm trying to find out how protective, well it does it protect infants from getting meningitis? How many strands of pneumococcal is actually in that vaccination?
Well, there are 7 strains of pneumococcal germs in the vaccine. And when they made the vaccine, when they started about 8 or 9 years ago putting this vaccine together, they put the 7 most common strains of pneumococcal germs into the vaccine. And now we've been able to dramatically lower all the cases of pneumococcal disease and meningitis from those 7 strains. Now there are dozens of other strains of pneumococcal disease, other pneumococcal bacteria that are not covered in the vaccine, and we're seeing those strains of the disease show up more and more now. And so the manufacturers are working at making a newer form of pneumococcal vaccine that incorporates it incorporates the old strains plus the more common new strains that are coming up. So we'll have a better vaccine in a few years, and that's kind of expected to happen when you come out with a vaccine for a germ that has many, many strains. you expect to eliminate the vaccine strains, but then you expect other strains to increase, and they're gonna come out with a better vaccine to combat that soon.
Because I have heard that they are trying to come up with the 13 M strands of vaccine for pneumococcal. Is that?
Yes, you know, I don't know how many strains it is. I don't know the exact number, but that sounds about right.
Okay. Now, what would you recommend the parents who are a little bit hesitant about giving vaccination to their children? In the practice that we do, we are more of an alternative clinic, and most of our patients, their children either get the minimum amount of vaccinations or do homeopathic vaccination or just don't do any vaccinations at all. And, of course, most of them are breastfed and everything. So
right.
I was trying to see what your recommendations would be regarding those patients, the parents who just really are very hesitant about giving vaccinations.
Yeah, well, I have a lot of recommendations for parents that are hesitant. First of all, I agree with you that the babies should breastfeed for at least a year, but 2 years is better. These babies should stay out of group child care. They shouldn't be put into a big child care with lots of other babies because that baby's, more likely to get sick with something that could be serious. I also recommend that the babies stay out of church nurseries for about the first 2 years of life if you're not going to vaccinate. I understand, parents who don't vaccinate. I have some families in my practice that don't vaccinate. And I understand that these parents, they basically believe that the risk of the vaccines is higher than the risk of the diseases, or maybe equal, or close to equal. And I agree that the vaccines do have some risk. Of course, vaccines can have some side effects, and there's some risk there. And some parents just aren't comfortable with taking that vaccine risk with their babies. They would rather risk the natural course of the disease. They would rather risk what might naturally happen during life instead of giving the baby something artificial like a vaccine and risking a side effect. So I understand that. I personally believe that the risk of the diseases is higher than the risk of the vaccine side effects, but I can understand how some parents are uncomfortable with it, and I have to respect their decision as long as they're making an educated decision.
Okay.
I will add, parents who are hesitant but feel like they do want some vaccines, they want to pick and choose the vaccines that are much more important, but maybe they want to skip the vaccines that are less important. And they only want to protect their baby from the diseases that could be potentially fatal. Something, a disease that their baby's at a big risk of catching and suffering harm from. And in my book, I kind of give a couple different vaccine schedules. One is designed for parents who do want all the vaccines, and then another schedule is designed for parents who just want to pick and choose the most important vaccines. And that choosy schedule is called my selective vaccine schedule, and it only gives the babies the two meningitis vaccines, the DTaP vaccine, which protects against whooping cough, and then the rotavirus vaccine, which protects against an intestinal vomiting and diarrhea disease that happens in infants. Those are kind of the four most important shots, PC, Hib, DTaP, and rotavirus. And I outline a way that parents can only get those shots because those are the most important, and then skip some of the shots that are designed to protect against the less risky diseases.
Okay. So you do recommend a rotavirus, actually, because I'm looking at your the alternative vaccine schedule
mm-hmm.
in your book. which is actually really nice because it's a it tells, you know, the parents can go straight to the to that part and decide, and then look into and look back to the book and see what those vaccines are made of and what the alternatives might be and what the pros and cons might be, and makes it much easier. Makes it much easier for them to decide.
Right.
Go
right.
ahead.
And you can see on my schedule how I spread the shots out. I only give about 2 shots at a time instead of as many as 6, like most doctors like to give. And so it allows parents who are worried and who are hesitant, it allows them to more carefully and gradually vaccinate in a way that, I believe lowers the chance of reaction.
Yes, yes, I see that. Now, I also wanted to ask you about the rotavirus, because that's a fairly new vaccination.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Rotavirus has been out for, I think, about 2 years now. The disease is it's a pretty bad vomiting and diarrhea disease that goes around in child daycares, in church nurseries. Occasionally, but less commonly, it might hit a baby who's not in daycare, maybe a stay-at-home baby has only a small risk of catching rotavirus. But during the fall and the winter, this time of year, mm-hmm. rotavirus spreads all over, and any place where there's groups of infants together, and these infants can get very dehydrated from all the vomiting and all the diarrhea, and we we tragically have about 50 fatalities from rotavirus in our country every year, where a baby just gets so dehydrated they pass away. And we have a lot of hospitalizations. We have tens of thousands of hospitalizations every year. So rotavirus is definitely a bad disease. And we give babies a vaccine at 2 months, 4 months, and 6 months to help prevent them from catching this disease. I agree it's a pretty important vaccine. You know, I think a parent who maybe is breastfeeding and has a stay-at-home baby where the baby's not going to be, you know, exposed to a lot of other babies, maybe the vaccine's a little less important for that kind of baby because the mm-hmm. chance of catching rotavirus is much lower.
Okay. Now, how about from adults to babies? How would that work if the good hand washing, and would that take care of it or not really?
No, that's how you prevent rotavirus is good hand washing. Whenever you're moving, whenever you're changing a baby's diaper or you're going to the bathroom yourself, wash your hands very well, and you probably won't pass the rotavirus on to another baby. You know, we don't really see rotavirus much in adults. If we do, the adults don't really get that sick from it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure it's a disease that really only seems to hit the younger kids.
Yes, yes. Oh, and then I also see in your alternative schedule you definitely want, you were mentioning something about diphtheria, tetanus, and DTaP.
Right.
And wanted to talk to you about that too. Just wanted to see what you think, and maybe you can inform us more about it.
Well, the DTaP vaccine protects against 3 diseases. 2 of the diseases, the babies in the United States don't have any risk of catching. But 1 of the diseases, babies do have a big risk of catching in the U.S. The 2 diseases in the shot that aren't a risk for babies are diphtheria and tetanus. We don't see these diseases in infants and young children in the United States anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But many decades ago, we did have these diseases. And so they put the DTP vaccine together as a triple vaccine to help eliminate diphtheria and help keep down tetanus. And then the P part of the vaccine is the pertussis, or whooping cough. They put this vaccine together many decades ago when all 3 of those diseases were a problem. Nowadays, the only disease that we see among infants is the P part of that vaccine, the pertussis. they don't make a vaccine with just pertussis in it. They only make it mixed together with pertussis and the diphtheria and the tetanus. So when babies get that vaccine, because they need the pertussis protection, they're getting two vaccines that are, you know, kind of unnecessary for young babies, but there's really no alternative right now. If you want pertussis protection, you have to get the diphtheria and the tetanus along with it.
Now, is there any alternative in other countries, in European countries, or they are using the same thing, or we don't know really?
I don't know. I haven't investigated enough what they're doing in other countries to really be able to answer that.
Okay. Now, I know that for pertussis, actually, it's actually coming back, and you adults can give that to babies too. Is that right?
Yeah. Pertussis is a disease that it's very important to understand the risk of pertussis for a young baby. Pertussis, no, it's not really coming back. It's not more now than it used to be. It's kind of been pretty much the same for the last 20 years.
Okay.
Or so, where we have around about 15,000 cases every year in the United States that are diagnosed, and it's a bad coughing disease. You cough so hard that it's kind of hard to catch your breath, and when an adult has a whooping cough, they can have these big coughing fits, but an adult can get through it no problem. When a young baby catches whooping cough, they cough so hard that they can't stop coughing and catch a breath, and so their oxygen levels in their blood decrease, and they're not getting enough oxygen to their brain during the coughing fits, and so some of these babies will actually will actually pass away. You know, we see some fatalities in babies because they're just coughing so bad. Fortunately, the fatality rates, they're pretty low. We you know, tragically see about 20 babies die every year of pertussis. It's not a high number, fortunately, but it is very tragic for those families. And the only babies that we see die from pertussis or whooping cough, it's the same thing, are babies younger than, who are 6 months of age or younger. That's where we see all the fatalities. Babies that are older than 6 months and toddlers and preschoolers, if they catch whooping cough, it might be a tough, you know, few weeks of coughing, and they can get fairly sick from it, but we don't see fatalities from it in that age group. So it's really just the biggest risk for the young babies. And, it can be passed from adults and older children down to young babies. Any babies that are not vaccinated are very susceptible to it, and any adults or teenagers who have lost their vaccine protection because their vaccines wore off, those older groups can catch whooping cough and pass it to the young babies. So I think it's important to understand all about whooping cough, especially if you are not going to vaccinate. You have to understand what the risk is that you're taking.
Exactly. Now, if the people around the baby who has not been vaccinated, they don't have any symptoms, what is the chance of the baby actually getting whooping cough from them?
No, you have to have symptoms.
You have to have
pass
symptoms.
It along. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And also wanted to, you were mentioning about I was looking at your alternative vaccine schedule, and I don't see a hepatitis B vaccine till they are a little bit older.
Right.
And I wanted to get your point on that,
Yeah, that's a great question. The thing about my alternative vaccine schedule is it doesn't give a baby or a child any vaccines until the child is old enough to really need that vaccine. It gives the shots, you know, what we do is normally babies get a hepatitis B vaccine during, you know, the day they're born, and they get two more doses in the first 6 months. Hepatitis B is a sexually transmitted disease, though, so there's no way for a young baby to catch hepatitis B. So my schedule, I take a more logical look at when you should give a baby a vaccine. And I don't give the babies the hepatitis B vaccine during infancy because there's no risk of catching it. Now, what I do give is I like to give the hepatitis B vaccine when the baby is 2.5 or 3 or 4 years old before they start entering school. Because even though hepatitis B is a sexually transmitted disease, you could still catch it accidentally through some sort of accidental blood exposure. If someone has an accident or they're injured and they're bleeding, if that, say, for an adult, if an adult was a hepatitis B carrier, if they're infected with hep B, their blood could theoretically contaminate and or get on some children or something, and then the kids could accidentally catch hepatitis B. So I skip the vaccine during infancy when there's no risk, but I think it's a pretty good idea to do once your child is going to be going out into the world, going to school, and going to be around a lot of other kids and adults and, you know, outside of your control. And so then you give them hepatitis B protection. Now, some parents might also decide to skip hepatitis B until their child is a teenager and not give the vaccine when they're younger because the risk is pretty low, and wait until the risk of catching hepatitis B is much higher once a teenager is going to become sexually active.
Okay. Now, I also wanted to ask you about polio. I'm looking at the schedule, and you're mentioning only one polio shot when they are 9 months old.
Right.
Is that an oral polio you're talking about, or?
No, it's the injected polio.
Yeah,
we don't use oral polio anymore in the United States. The oral polio vaccine was a liquid that infants swallowed, and it went into the intestines and created immunity. We don't use that one anymore because there's a lot of side effects from the oral polio vaccine. A lot of very severe side effects. In fact, the old oral polio vaccine could actually cause polio disease.
It could cause
a person to become paralyzed. So we stopped using that vaccine, and now we use an injected vaccine.
Okay.
And I suggest that, you know, starting around 9 months of age, babies start getting their polio shots.
And what is the reasoning behind that?
Well, the regular schedule that the government likes to use calls for polio vaccine at 2 months, and 4 months, and 6 months.
Yes.
In my schedule, because polio doesn't exist in the United States,
mm-hmm.
we don't have it anymore, and there hasn't been a case of polio in the U.S. in almost 25 years now. So it's not a disease that's going around in our country, and so young little babies in the first few months of life, they don't really need polio protection yet.
Okay.
But if everyone stops giving polio vaccine, we would have a risk of having polio come back. We could see polio come back into our country if all the children and growing into teenagers and young adults, if everyone stopped vaccinating against polio completely, then we would have a big risk of an outbreak. So I do think getting polio vaccine is pretty important. It's not so much to protect each individual person from a disease that's going around. It's more to keep our country as a whole protected.
Okay.
And so I delay the shot on my schedule so that we're not overloading the young baby with so many shots right at the beginning. We're delaying polio shot a little while. But I do think ultimately at some point it is pretty important to get your polio protection so that you have that coverage.
Okay, that makes sense. Now the other thing was the chickenpox. I remember most of us, when you are older, the older people, a lot of us had chickenpox. And I remember it was a horrible, horrible feeling to have the chickenpox. But if a mother, a parent doesn't want to give chickenpox vaccine, is there any other alternative other than, you know, the baby will get the chickenpox? Would that harm the baby get having the chicken pox?
Well, you know, chicken pox is not very fun to go through, like you said. It's a week of itching and some fever, and you're left with some little spots, you know, mm-hmm. maybe little scars from it. But fortunately, most people who catch chickenpox get through it without any trouble, and then they move on, and then they have their natural lifelong immunity from it. The thing with chickenpox is, for every 65,000 cases that we see, 65,000 people that catch it, will have about one fatality. One Ooh. Person will have some severe complications from the disease and then will die. And we, you know, in the country right now, we have about five cases, we have about five fatalities from chickenpox every year. So if everyone got chickenpox vaccines and if we completely eliminated the disease, we would be saving a few lives every year and preventing a lot of people from having to go through that uncomfortable week of illness. However, the thing with chickenpox vaccine is it doesn't last forever. It seems to only last about 10 years or so. And so anyone who gets the vaccine as a child, their protection is going to wear off, and they're going to need to get boosters of the chickenpox shot about every 10 years as a teenager and as an adult in order to keep their immunity. Some parents prefer they would just rather get their kids the actual infection so that the child gets better immunity. And I think either decision is okay. I mean, I can understand parents wanting their kids to get the better immunity, the lifelong immunity, and maybe take the risk of going through the disease. I can understand that. I don't think that's a bad decision. I think that's a fine decision. And then some parents will find that they can't get their kids infected. You go through 10 years of school, but you don't catch chickenpox because it's not as common anymore. And if you find your teenager hasn't caught chickenpox, then you can consider getting the vaccine at that point so that they don't go into their adult years with no protection at all.
That makes sense. Now, you mentioned about the chickenpox causing death and has, you know, very short, small amount of mortality. What are the causes of the mortalities? Is it meningitis? Is it?
Yeah. Some kids will get a meningitis from the chickenpox. They can get a bad pneumonia from the chickenpox.
Okay.
Some kids will get a really bad a skin infection. Their spots will get really infected from a very severe bacteria. And that causes, that gets into their system and causes a real bad internal infection.
Okay.
Yeah, those are the reasons. Fortunately, those things are not common, but they do happen, and parents need to realize what that risk is if they're going to skip the chickenpox vaccine.
Now, I wanted to go back to rotavirus. We talked about that extensively, about the diarrhea, nausea, vomiting in little babies, that it actually can be very severe before 6 months of age. I also wanted to ask you about the side effects of the vaccine, which is intussusception, and if you can tell us something about it and how often you have seen it actually.
Yeah, this intussusception is a tough word to say. It's a condition where the intestines it's hard to explain, but in real simple terms, the intestines get twisted and folded up inside each other and cause a blockage. And so the baby or the child with intussusception would be in very severe pain and start vomiting, and then they'll start bleeding, out of their bottom from this blockage. And it's very severe. It's a surgical emergency. It makes the baby very, very sick, and it's very life-threatening. Now, intussusception happens just for no reason in in a small number of babies and children every year. It's just this random condition that seems to strike for no reason. Now, where the vaccine comes into play is about 9 years ago, or 10 years ago, there was a rotavirus vaccine that was created to protect against rotavirus. And what they found after using the vaccine for about a year in our country, they found a lot more cases of intussusception in young babies than they otherwise would have expected. And they studied it and they realized that the rotavirus vaccine 10 years ago could actually be a trigger for intussusception. And so they took that vaccine off the market. They stopped using it. Now, 8 years later, about 2 years ago now, they came out with two newer rotavirus vaccines, completely remade. They started over from scratch. The new vaccines are very different from the old vaccine. And these new vaccines, they don't seem to be a trigger for intussusception. When they started using the two new rotavirus vaccines 2 years ago, we haven't seen more intussusception in babies like we did with the other vaccine 10 years ago. So the belief now is that the newer vaccines don't cause intussusception, or if they do, it would be an extremely, extremely rare chance of that happening. So with the latest information that we have, I don't think the new vaccines are any worry as far as intussusception goes.
Oh, so they haven't seen that many increase in that side effects in the
exactly.
new babies who are getting the new vaccine.
Exactly, they've seen no increase and they even before they released this vaccine into the public, they gave the vaccine to tens of thousands of babies. And then they studied those babies, and they compared it to other babies that didn't get the vaccine, and they saw no difference in the random accidental intussusception. They saw no difference in the two groups, in the two study groups. And we haven't seen any increase in intussusception since the vaccine came out. So I don't think that seems to be any sort of worry that parents need to be concerned with.
Okay. Well, good. I wanted to ask you a few more questions about the vaccinations and then get to the really nitty-gritty, side effects that the most people are really concerned about.
Right.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about the flu for infants, and I wanted to get your point of view on the flu and also for the DTaP. I think after the mother, before the mother is and the baby, the infant is leaving the hospital, the mother is offered a adult booster for DTM, like a large AP, as a booster to help with preventing the infant to get the pertussis.
Right.
And what would you recommend if a family is not getting the child, or even if they are, they might be wanting to start the pertussis a little bit later if the baby was born, during the fall season or some winter season this time of the year. Would you recommend them for everybody who's around the baby to get this vaccination till the baby does get vaccinated?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the time of year doesn't matter for pertussis, first of all. But, the idea is we don't give babies any pertussis vaccine until they're 2 months.
Okay.
But we do see a lot of babies in the first 2 months of life before they ever had a chance to get the vaccine. We see pertussis happening in those young babies because they're catching it from their older siblings or the mom or the dad. And so they came out with a new idea. They made an adult version of the DTP vaccine, the pertussis vaccine, to give moms, when they give birth, and to give the vaccine to dads as well. And then also to make sure any teenagers in the house are up to date on their pertussis vaccine. And any school-age children who've been getting all the shots all along, they have pertussis vaccines already. So the idea is to protect everyone around the baby from whooping cough so they don't pass it to the young baby in the first few months of life. It's a good idea. I mean, I think, you know, it sounds like a really good idea. I guess the only hesitation I have about the adult DTP vaccine is that adults seem to have more side effects from vaccines than children do. Adults seem to react a lot worse. They get achy, they get sore, they get feverish. They seem to react more to vaccines than children. Now, most of those reactions aren't severe. Most of them are harmless, and the adults can take it okay. But I'm just a little bit concerned about that, and then also concerned with any new vaccine that comes out, like this new vaccine, the new DTP vaccine for adults. We don't know a lot about the adult side effects yet, and so it's such a brand new idea. I'm a little hesitant to recommend to my patients that they jump right on it until we know more about how adults handle this type of vaccine.
That's a very good point. Because it's only a year or so old, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's not that old.
Yeah, I think it's been around about a year, maybe a year and a half.
Okay. Very good idea. Now, I also wanted to talk to you about the flu. I know the babies are not they are not supposed to get the flu shot till they're a little bit older. So I wanted to see what your points are on that, and as far as protecting the infants, what would you recommend for the surrounding, for the people around the baby?
Okay, the flu, every year it kills about 100 babies and children in the United States, which is very tragic, and then it kills several thousand elderly every year. It would be great to be able to prevent the flu. We give babies flu shots as young as 6 months of age, and the new recommendation is to get a flu shot every year until you're 18 years old, from young baby all the way up to 18. The two things about the flu shot that I don't like for babies is, number one, since they started using flu shots in young babies, researchers have tried to look at how well the shot works. And there have been some published reviews and research studies that show that they can't really prove that the flu vaccine works very well in babies and young children. They know it works pretty well in adults and older children, but they can't actually prove that it works very well in younger kids and in babies. So I don't think the flu vaccine works as well in young babies as most other vaccines do. That's one issue with the flu shot. My main problem with the flu shot is most flu shots still contain mercury. Mm-hmm. We all know about the mercury controversy and how they've taken mercury out of almost all the vaccines except flu shots. Most flu shots still have the mercury in it. Now, some companies make flu shots without mercury, but those flu shots are hard to come by. They're harder to find, and they're in a smaller supply. So I think, first of all, anyone who's going to get a flu shot should really make sure their doctor is giving their baby a mercury-free flu shot. I think that's very important. On my website right now, I have a list of all the flu shots for this year, and I list which ones are mercury-free and which ones contain mercury. Whether or not parents should give their babies the flu shot, it's a hard decision. I suppose a baby who's in a child care situation around a lot of other young kids that baby would be more at risk of catching the flu. But a stay-at-home breastfed baby would probably be very low risk of catching the flu. So I think parents can take it as a case-by-case decision based on what they think their own baby's risk is.
Okay. The next one that I wanted to for you to sort of explain to us and the listeners about the difference between PC vaccination and the meningococcal for 18 to 13-year-olds that you have mentioned.
Right. The PC meningitis, that only occurs in young children. Meningococcal disease occurs in children of all ages, young children, school-age children, teenagers, and adults. Meningococcal is a really, really bad form of meningitis.
So it's not the same disease.
No, it's not the same.
The PC is pneumo.
Right, it's not the same disease at all.
Okay.
Very different diseases. But and meningococcal is much more severe than PC disease. Now, the meningococcal vaccine, we only give that to teenagers because even though the disease occurs in younger children, we see an increase among high school and college age kids,
mm-hmm.
and the disease is more severe in the high school and college age kids than it is in younger kids. It's severe anytime you catch it, but it's more severe in the older kids. So they came out with a vaccine to give teenagers. It's a one-dose vaccine. You only need one dose. And that protects the kids in high school and the kids going off to college from catching this college, type of meningitis. They're working on trying to get the vaccine to be used in younger kids as well, kids down to age 2, because the disease can occur in the younger kids, and it's a very severe disease, at any age. So we might see meningococcal vaccine move down to age 2. It isn't yet, but we might see that in the near future. I think it's a pretty important vaccine.
Now, how often do they have to, the teenager have to get it? Is it an annual vaccine?
No, it's a one-year. It's a one-dose. One time.
Okay. And, of course, we all know about the MMR and the other stuff. And I wanted to get, because in your book, which I really highly recommend our readers to check out your book, it's a great, great resource, the vaccine book. You also mentioned the studies about the side effects of MMR, the autism, the ADHD, different things. And I wanted to get to your point of view again, if you can tell us what you have found as far as the aluminum toxicity, the mercury, and different things in the vaccinations.
Well, that's a lot of.
I know.
Well, the MMR, I guess to keep it real simple is we don't know, if the MMR vaccine triggers, any of those long-term problems like asthma or eczema or ADD. We don't know that. But I think one thing we see from the MMR vaccine is a lot of kids will get fevers and will get achy. They'll get rashes. They'll get really uncomfortable reactions from the MMR vaccine. And in my book, I suggest splitting up the MMR vaccine into separate parts, just one M, and then many months later getting another M, and then many months after that getting the R part of it, splitting it up so that you're only getting one of those components at a time. I think babies will handle the vaccines better that way, and you don't see as many MMR side effects if you spread that shot out.
Well, I know in other countries they do have the mumps, measles, and rubella separately, but I haven't seen much in the U.S. I guess we are bringing them back again, we are using them.
Right. They're in a very low supply in the United States, the single MMR vaccines. The country has run out of them, and they're working on making more. And so parents sometimes will have to wait until their doctor can get the vaccine in if they do want to split it up. But I do think it is worth splitting up the MMR to help lower side effects.
Yes. Now, I know about, as I said, there are so much good information in the book. I really recommend our readers, or our listeners actually, to get your book. It's called The Vaccine Book by Robert W. Sears, M.D. And I know you have your own practice in California.
Yes.
And are you also writing any other books? Do you have any other books? Are you doing the, I think you have the Sears Parenting Library. Are you, do you do co-authors with the other Dr. Sears, or this is your library?
Yeah, no, I've written, the vaccine book was written just by myself, but as a family, we all write a lot of books together in the parenting library, and I've helped write six of the books so far. We have a couple books coming out. I have a book coming out about how to live a really organic, green, natural life, and how to raise a baby, in a more green, natural, organic environment. We have a book. Coming out just about general pediatric illnesses and how to take care of any illness that comes around when your baby gets sick. We always have some sort of book in the works.
So you guys are related to each other?
Yeah. My dad. My
oh,
father, Bill,
okay.
Here. And then me and my brother Jim and my mom also helps write some of the books.
Okay, because to be honest with you, I think I have a lot of your parents' books.
Yeah, you might. Yeah, my dad's been writing books for 30 years.
Yes. So when I got this book, I sort of automatically thought it was your dad's, and then I was looking at the picture, and I'm like, wait.
It's like, gosh, he
looks He is a transformation. He looks so young.
Yeah.
He hasn't aged at all.
Yeah.
But it has been a pleasure, a truly pleasure to talk to you, and I am. And if you want to let our listeners to also know about your website, because I was looking at your website, and your website has wealth of knowledge in there. It's a lot of information, not necessarily just for everybody, not necessarily for people, your own patient, but just for parents, for caregivers. It was a really wonderful website that I also recommend our listeners to go and check it out.
Yeah, thank you. It's our family website. It's askdrsears.com. And then we also have specifically thevaccinebook.com, thevaccinebook.com. And parents can go, they can read, a little bit of the book on there. And there's also a parents forum where parents can chat with other parents, and I answer questions there. And a lot of good vaccine-related information and resources on the site.
Well, thank you very much, and happy holidays to you. I really appreciate you taking the time during the holidays to talk to us and to inform us. This was extremely informative to me, and I learned a lot of, because I just had a new baby too. So it has been a pleasure talking to you and learning so much. And the book has so much information, and it's very easy to understand, actually, because this, wondering how it could have been much harder, but you have made every chapter so precise and to different, everything has its own place and very easy for most people to read and understand.
Yeah, so, most vaccine books that I looked through are so dry and hard to read and confusing and complicated. I tried to make it very, very, very simple and give all the information parents needed, but in a way that I think that they could read through in several days without getting overwhelmed and understand it easily and give them a whole thorough look. And there's even a little bit of humor in there if you look really hard.
Yes. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us and with our listeners. I really appreciate it. Please give my love to your family and best in everything. I'm looking forward to maybe in the future still talk to you maybe regarding your new books that are coming out.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Well, this is Dr. Anari Motahaf-Ford. We are talking to Dr. Robert W. Sears, who's a pediatrician in California, regarding his book, The Vaccine Book. Very informative. I strongly recommend everybody to check it out. And we also wanted to mention that our clinic is at Millennium Healthcare and Plastico in Atlanta. Feel free to give us a call, 770-457-4677. And we do actually alternative medicine, integrated medicine. We have a homeopath, we have acupuncturist, we have a chiropractor who does help with NAIT and help with different allergies. We have also a plastic and reconstructive surgery, a medical spa area, and of course I am a family physician, so we do, we take care of the whole family, mostly through integrated medicine. So the clinic is actually very, it's a wonderful place, it's a very centering place. And when you get in there, it's such a warm and it's a very nurturing area. Please feel free to give us a call or check out the www.plastikos.com. And you can also learn about Millennium Healthcare through Plastikos website. And what the different things that we offer, facilities that we offer. But it's a very well-rounded clinic, and which take care of the whole family. We take care of parents and peace, babies. Have a great day, and talk to you soon. Bye.
I'm sick and tired of always feeling sick and tired, and I don't want to take a lot of prescription drugs to feel better. Isn't there a better way?
Millennium Healthcare offers natural solutions to your health problems. Millennium Healthcare is qualified healthcare professionals working with you to restore your health and wellness. Whether it's a caring physician, one of...
Please join us every Saturday morning for Temple of Health Radio Show, brought to you by Plastikos and Millennium Healthcare. Our holistic medical practices in Atlanta are committed to community education. Our shows bring you national authors on topics of health alternatives, new scientific breakthroughs, and spiritual medicine.